Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christogene Internet Radio. Today is Friday, June 5th, 2020. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening we are going to present part two of our commentary on the Gospel of Solomon, the Introduction to Wisdom. Solomon's Introduction to Wisdom. The introduction to our program was just last week, and this evening we are going to expound on that and add to that to a great extent, but we will also get a little further into the text of the Wisdom of Solomon than we had last week, where we only presented a commentary on the first verse. In the opening presentation of our commentary on the Wisdom of Solomon, we provided and refuted many of the popular academic opinions of the work and the frequently repeated criticisms concerning the nature of its text, by which the provenance and veracity of the work have long been challenged. So although we have already provided commentary on the opening verse of the text, which we also hope to continue here, we realize that some of the newer material discussing the Wisdom of Solomon had further developed criticisms which also must be addressed. So before continuing, we shall do that here. In the introduction to its own presentation of the Wisdom of Solomon, the New English translation of the Septuagint, which we will call NETS for the balance of this presentation, NETS claims, under the subtitle Character of the Greek, that there is widespread recognition that the Wisdom of Solomon was composed in Greek. The book is an example of a protreptic work, an exhortation to adopt a particular philosophy, and it deploys literary genres familiar from Hellenistic rhetorical texts, including the diatribe, the problem genre, and the comparison, or synchresis. Correspondingly, the book is written in a good Greek style and shows none of the characteristics of translation Greek. Yet, it is commonly exhibited that the Book of Proverbs is also an example of a protreptic work, an exhortation to adopt a particular philosophy. And further, it is commonly exhibited, and it is absolutely manifest, that the literary diatribe is a common feature of the writings of the Hebrew prophets. So these aren't things which are merely Hellenistic. Some examples of classical Greek literature have been recognized as having the attributes of the genre more recently identified as the problem play, such as the 5th century work of Euripides titled Alcestis, as are other early works, as well as the Book of Job, which is found in the Bible, which we could certainly esteem to date to as early as the 12th or 13th centuries BC. However, it definitely predates the classical Greek period. Lastly, the synchresis, or synchresis, as it may be pronounced in English, and that's how it's spelled, is a literary form of comparison, and it has been identified as a feature of both the Gospel of John and some of the epistles of Paul, especially in the Epistle to the Hebrews. But forms of the so-called synchresis are also found in the Hebrew Old Testament. So none of these features attributed to the wisdom of Solomon are exclusively Hellenistic. They belong to both earlier Greek and earlier Hebrew writings. And the entire protestation against the antiquity of the wisdom of Solomon is therefore null and void. It's ridiculous. In a book which concerns the Gospel of John, written by one Dennis Silva, the author, discussing the synchresis, states, Plutarch was the early 2nd century AD, I believe. Plutarch made extensive use of this literary device in his parallel lives. He would make comparisons of great figures in politics and war and philosophy from all throughout history, very often a Greek and a Roman, and that the synchresis is the entire purpose of parallel lives. The use of it far antedates him, meaning predates, though appearing already in Homer and some Greek tragedies. Characteristically, synchresis often takes place in ancient Jewish, or better, Hebrew, writings in less direct narrative analogies that require the reader to discern from literary suggestions the connections, similarities, and differences, and to draw inferences from them. The author goes on to elaborate, and his statements are well cited. We will not suffer the elaborations here, but our purpose is only to show that the synchresis certainly does appear in the Old Testament, although it is not always found in forms as developed as those which are found in the Wisdom of Solomon or the Greek philosophers. And that is very much the same as what we had concluded in our discussion of the Sorites as it is found in Wisdom and elsewhere in the Old Testament. While for at least most of their criticisms, the Wisdom of Solomon, the editors of the Wisdom of Solomon in the New English translation of the Septuagint, or NETS, had cited a 1970 book by J.M. Rees, Hellenistic Influence on the Book of Wisdom and Its Consequences, as their source. Their primary source. Neither is that work unchallenged by other mainstream academics. In a footnote on page 18 of the book, The Exodus Story in the Wisdom of Solomon, A Study in Biblical Interpretation, we find the following. J.M. Rees argues that the genre of synchresis is not found in the Hebrew Bible, but existed in Attic orators and Hellenistic historicans or historians. The author then cites two of Rees's books where he evidently made such statements, the Book of Wisdom, Song of Songs, and Hellenistic Influence. Then the author responds by stating, however, examples of synchresis can be found in the Hebrew Bible. Isaiah chapter 56, verse 13, Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 through 20, the first Psalm, and Proverbs chapters 10 through 15. The footnotes supply citations for these examples. One from a book on Paranetic Literature, and we will define that, by J.G. Gammy. And then it concludes that, according to Gammy, synchresis is a subgenre of Paranetic literature, and this actually only makes sense, rather than a separate form or genre. Paranetic, as defined by the Collins English Dictionary, is simply of or relating to moral and ethical instruction, or paranesis, something which is commonly found in scripture, So it should be no wonder that it is a feature found in the writings attributed to Solomon. Both Proverbs and this book, The Wisdom of Solomon. In this aspect of its criticism of wisdom, Netz concludes that correspondingly, as Rees, in his important study of the literary style and vocabulary of wisdom, has shown, the book is written in a good Greek style and shows none of the characteristics of translation Greek. But now we hope to have demonstrated that what Rees has supposedly shown is not necessarily true. However, since Netz has further criticisms of the Wisdom of Solomon, and most of them are also based on a blind acceptance of errant conclusions by J.M. Rees, then we must have further criticism of Netz. These criticisms next include an admission by Netz on the use of the Hebraic form of parallelism in wisdom. The frequency of parallelism in wisdom cannot lightly be overlooked, and Netz only mentioned it in a short note, mostly because J.M. Rees seems to have been largely ignorant of the phenomenon. This is discussed in a paper titled, and Rees is explicitly named, in a paper titled The Poetry of the Wisdom of Solomon Reconsidered, by Eric D. Raymond. In his paper, although Raymond seems to take for granted all of the claims that Greek elements of grammar identified in wisdom are originally or exclusively Greek, he says in an abstract that wisdom's form is a good deal more complex than these synopses suggest. Parallelism is realized in a number of ways in the Hebrew scriptures, and its manifestation in this apocryphal book is a unique combination of different patterns. The present study aims at a detailed description of wisdom structure through a close study of the parallelism and verse length of the book's first 15 verses, and through a comparison of these patterns with those in Hebrew poems, meaning the Hebrew books of wisdom and other Hebrew poems that are found in scripture. Of course, when we present our own commentary on wisdom, we will focus on the meaning and not the structure, since our purposes are spiritual edification and enlightenment and not mere literary inquiry. But the parallelisms of wisdom are not unique to wisdom, as many of them also appear in other parts of the Septuagint. Raymond provided a list of semantic parallels from Wisdom Chapter 1, which are formed from word pairs of synonyms and antonyms and are quite prominent in the Hebrew language of certain other scriptures. And he states, of these 27 semantic parallels in the first 15 verses of Wisdom Chapter 1, 13 appear parallel elsewhere in the Septuagint. Of these 13 examples, 4 are set in parallel only once outside this wisdom poem, meaning that 9 of them appear repeatedly outside of wisdom. The author demonstrates how this feature of wisdom is similarly found in Job, Proverbs, and Psalms. We would assert that all of these books were written in the same period, Job being only a couple of centuries earlier than the others. Much of Job was also written in a poetic format, rather than the plain prose of its translations. After a brief reference to parallelisms in wisdom, Netz proceeds to make claims of its Hellenistic origin based on its use of the hyperbaton, both the separation of the article from its substantive and hyperbaton not linked to an article. Hyperbaton is when words are purposely, the word order is purposely switched around, both for literary purposes and to make the sense more explicit. So you might see an adjective or some other word in between the definite article and the noun that it belongs to. An adjective, a participle, or some other word, where we would expect it to precede or follow the article. The ball is red, or the ball rolls. And we would see in Greek often words that would translate to the ball red is, or the red ball is, or the rolls ball. But you would know, reading Greek, exactly what it's saying. You wouldn't get those words confused. That's a hyperbaton. There are other forms of hyperbaton. There are hyperbaton that were mistakes in the Septuagint, that probably were errors in grammar that shouldn't be there. But this argument is hard to address, to refute, or to validate without a thorough examination of all of the Greek Septuagint texts and without knowing which specific texts had different translators who were consistent or inconsistent in their own methods. In any event, the correct or incorrect use of hyperbaton in the Wisdom of Solomon is immaterial, as it can only really prove that a particular translator or scribe had a better or worse education in Greek than all or many of the other scribes of the Septuagint. It does not prove original authorship. The quality of the Greek grammar of Paul's epistles also varied. Evidently, because he had a different amanuensis at different times. And amanuensis is the person who actually writes the epistle. Paul, as it is evident in his epistle to the Romans, in his epistle to the Galatians, Paul had very bad eyesight and therefore used an amanuensis. He spoke out the epistle and somebody else had written it out using their own nuances in grammar and writing. But as late as the 2nd century AD, as it is evident in the work of the grammarian, Apollonius Discalus, Apollonius Discalus. He was actually a very famous and considered one of the preeminent grammarians of Koine Greek. In his work, as late as the 2nd century AD, the Greek word order in grammar was still being disputed. In the Septuagint, hyperbaton seems to occur irregularly and often for different reasons, and it is debated concerning a section of Joshua chapter 10, as well as certain of the Psalms. And there are, in our notes this evening, just about everything I'm saying is cross-referenced to something at Google Books or archive.org or from some educational institution, so all the links are here. Even the epistles of Paul are criticized for presumably incorrect instances of hyperbaton. The next criticism of the Wisdom of Solomon then makes a statement that the rhetorical character of the Greek is likewise evident in the frequent occurrence of different types of wordplay, such as assonance and alliteration. But these features are also characteristic of the Psalms and other poetic Hebrew scriptures, which are clearly described in an article on Hebrew poetry found at encyclopedia.com and in many other sources. Next, it states, the author also employs various figures of speech that are typical of Hellenistic Greek, of which the Sorites of Wisdom chapter 6 verses 17 through 20 is merely the best known example. However, we have also shown, and we did this just last week in the first segment of this series, we have also shown that the Sorites or Sorites is indeed found in the Old Testament scriptures, and therefore that argument also fails. Turning to a discussion, and this gets worse because this criticism of the wisdom of Solomon is practically all garbage. If somebody brought this to me as a paper and said, please post this on your website, or if I was a college PhD and somebody brought this to me as a dissertation, it would go immediately into the paper shredder. Immediately, without a heartbeat. Turning to the discussion of the vocabulary of wisdom, the editors of Netz begin with the conclusion that the vocabulary of the wisdom of Solomon is quite distinctive within the context of the Septuagint and reflects the Hellenistic milieu in which the book was composed. Milieu, perhaps. The setting of the book. Once again, they said that, citing J.M. Rees, whose book should also be shredded. Then, taking for granted that wisdom was not written until the Hellenistic period, they set out to prove that conclusion by making examples from its vocabulary. Where they do that in their introduction, and because we do not have a full list from them, we can only assume that they chose the best examples they could find in order to support their conclusion. When, in the opening presentation of our commentary on wisdom, we addressed the false claims that the presumed author of wisdom was quoting from Isaiah and Job, we were forced to make that same assumption, that the few examples that they provide are what they consider to be the best examples. So if the best examples don't hold up, then the whole pile is covered with flies. In fact, in the Wikipedia article for the book of Job, we read, "The language of Job stands out for its conservative spelling and for its exceptionally large numbers of words and forms not found elsewhere in the Bible." But nobody wants to claim that the book of Job is somehow fraudulent or was somehow written by a non-Hebrew or somebody outside of Israel and Judah for that reason, that there are no criticisms against the book of Job for that reason. And then in the introduction for the Netz translation of Job from the Septuagint, we read, "The old Greek Job is a work of good literary quality. Absent are the usual Hebraisms that are telltale signs of translation Greek in much of the Septuagint corpus." There you have it. Job doesn't have any Hebraisms in it, according to them. So they still consider it a legitimate book of the Septuagint. But the Wisdom of Solomon is full of Hebraisms from end to end, and they say that it's not translation Greek, it's original Greek. Yet here they say that the Hebraisms in their introduction to Job, just a few pages away, their Hebraisms are the telltale signs of translation Greek. Come on, that's a double standard. That is so blatant. In spite of the abundant Hebraisms in the Wisdom of Solomon, and because of its good literary quality, they deny that wisdom could have been translated from Hebrew. The exact opposite conclusion from the same standards. How do you do that? How does that happen? Then, while they have noted the many words in wisdom which are unique within the Septuagint, in their introduction to the Greek translations of the Song of Songs. They state, the translator occasionally brings a clever mastery of Greek vocabulary, or even a flash of brilliance to the task. And then a little later on, very frequently, the Hebrew uses words that are unique or rare, and some of these are unfamiliar to our translator. He guesses their meanings from context, from etymology, and from their use in other books. Sometimes he apparently coins new words, such as kaliao and kardiao, that omicron omega succession in Greek vowels of the first person singular, in Greek verbs of the first person singular, is very difficult for me to figure out how to pronounce, because it's not really a diphthong. I should just say kalio and cardio, and eklakizo. Sometimes he makes a Greek word as it was never meant to serve, as it was never meant to serve. When all else fails, he transliterates. So this is the criticism of the translator, whoever translated the Song of Songs 2,300 years ago, perhaps, when the Septuagint was created. So they say he apparently coins new words. There are words in the Wisdom of Solomon, which we will see were never found elsewhere in writing from before the Wisdom of Solomon. Do the editors of Nets say that the author of Wisdom coined new words? No, they don't. They claim that they are Hellenistic religious terms, or Hellenistic psychological terms. And we will get to that. This is pitiful. It is pitiful that Nets also came from a university in England, and that this passes for university level scholarship, when in fact, it's pure trash. It's just trash. It's sad. So what is seen and is described positively or negatively as a feature of the Greek of Job or the Song of Songs is never used to criticize the provenance of those books, but they are inverted to become proofs of a Hellenistic origin of the Wisdom of Solomon. Clearly, the editors of Nets apply their own standards quite hypocritically from book to book. Now, to begin their arguments supporting the presumed Hellenistic vocabulary of the Wisdom of Solomon, the editors of Nets state, on the one hand, the author uses a number of words familiar from the Septuagint, but with their normal meaning in Greek. And they only have one example of this. For example, the word anagke occurs in Wisdom chapters 17 and 19 in the sense familiar from Greek of necessity, and they add fate, but I would not consider fate to be a definition of anagke, not at all. But when it is used in the Septuagint, in books translated from Hebrew, it always has the meaning distress, anguish, and they cite the 106th Psalm as an example of that. The Greek word, anagke, appears in 42 verses in the Septuagint and 17 in the New Testament. According to Liddell and Scott, anagke bears either meaning, force, constraint, or necessity, or, secondarily, bodily pain, anguish, or distress. And in that second sense, it was used at least as early as the 5th century BC by the tragic poet Sophocles. So, bearing either sense, this comment in Nets is clearly biased to consider the later sense, the secondary sense, to be outside of the normal meaning. That's not true. A secondary sense of the word, a definition in the secondary sense of the meaning of a word, is not abnormal. That's a bias, which is very clear here. In Tobit, in chapter 3 and in chapter 4, the word is used in both senses, one in Tobit chapter 3 and the other sense in Tobit chapter 4. In 2 Maccabees chapter 6 and 15, it is translated as constraint or compulsion in its primary sense, as it is in 3 Maccabees chapters 4 and 5, and also often in 4 Maccabees. Of the older scriptures, it is because they are all intertestamental period writings. Of the older scriptures, it is often translated into English as distress, but there are several places where it may have been translated as necessity. In the Christogenean New Testament, it is almost always translated as need or necessity or some synonym. Requirement, difficulty, constraint, force, forcibly, or even violence, all according to its primary sense, but as distress or anguish in just a couple of verses in its secondary sense. Although it sometimes differs in its opinion, the King James Version also translated the word in both senses, depending on which context it appears. So this argument is really based on opinions of secondary translators, translators from Greek into English, not on translators of Hebrew into Greek or original authors in Greek. It's not based on what they were thinking when they used the word. It's based on what English translators think when they translate the word. So this argument is also ridiculous, and it doesn't hold water. Now, Netz continues, and it says, on the other hand, the author uses, and we had already spoke about the frequency of words, we have already mentioned the frequency of words which occur in wisdom, which do not occur in other passages of the Septuagint. On the other hand, the author uses 335 words out of a total vocabulary of 1,734 different words that do not occur in any other canonical book of the Septuagint. And Rees has shown, and this is instrumental to our criticism, and Rees has shown that many of these, those 335 words, are characteristic of Hellenistic religious, philosophical, ethical, and psychological vocabulary. Now, here in response to this, we could not check every other Septuagint book to see how many or what ratio of original, unique words they use, words that aren't found in any other book. It is difficult to determine if such statistics have even been compiled for all of them. But the vocabulary of Isaiah, taken from Ralph's edition of the Septuagint, shows that there are 162 words in Isaiah that do not appear anywhere else in the Septuagint. Now that's half the number we have here in the Wisdom of Solomon. However, the Wisdom of Solomon, the writing is very distinct and practically unique for a unique purpose, from a unique perspective. Nearly as many more words in Isaiah appear only in only one or two other books. That may be expected, since some of the text in Isaiah is found in 2 Kings, and since there were three other contemporary prophets writing on the same subjects, Hosea, Amos, and Micah. So we would expect Isaiah to have a lower frequency of unique words, because his writing was not as unique to the scriptures overall than the writing in the Wisdom of Solomon. There was a word for idol, agalma, which appears only twice in Isaiah and once in 2 Maccabees, and the verb epilampo, to shine upon, which appears only once in Isaiah and once in the Wisdom of Solomon. But even if there are 200 similar circumstances, that does not prove that Isaiah was written in the Hellenistic period. Likewise, in a book titled Style and Context of Old Greek Job, meaning the Greek of the Septuagint, by Marieke Dont, D-H-O-N-T. I believe she's Belgian or Flemish. We read that there are many words in the book of Job which are rare or unique to the rest of the Septuagint. Many words and phrases which are common in classical Greek, and some words, such as dorodectes, which appears in Job chapter 15, which do not appear anywhere else in the Septuagint or in Greek. The editors of Netz did not include this information in their introduction to Job. Therefore, we esteem this argument regarding the Wisdom of Solomon to be without merit. It doesn't hold up when you compare it to Isaiah and to Job and use the same criticisms and see how they hold up in Isaiah and Job. Then the editors of Netz added the remark that the use of Hellenistic religious vocabulary in the Wisdom of Solomon is pervasive and includes words such as apogasma, and they define that as reflection, but it's wrong, and paredros, which means a sitting by, and they have hence throne partner, but that's not how the term was used in classical Greek. Both used to describe wisdom, or anonuma, which means nameless, and asukas, which means lifeless, both used in the description of idols, or Stephane Ferusa, which means wearing a crown, used of a virtuous but childless believer. And we're not going to get into their examples in our assessment of this argument. We are only going to see if these are really Hellenistic religious terms. We will discuss each of these words briefly to see if they are truly characteristic of Hellenistic religious vocabulary. Now, my thinking here is that if words are used in older classical Greek, Herodotus, Homer, the tragic poets, and they're used in the same sense that they are found in the Wisdom of Solomon, then it is just a slander to say that they are characteristic of Hellenistic religious vocabulary. And that is because our authors, our editors at Netz, haven't produced any citations from any Hellenistic religious writer outside of what's found in the Septuagint and the Wisdom of Solomon. So, what is the problem? If these words appear in classical Greek 200, 300 years before the beginning of the Hellenistic period, how could you make this accusation? You can't. This accusation is meaningless. These clowns at Netz reach millions of people with their introductions to these books, and they are 100% bullshit, at least in the case of the Wisdom of Solomon. I could tell you all the others are incomplete and have their own biases, but this here is just a pile of lies. First, the word apogasma is not a reflection, but radiance, effulgence of light beaming from a luminous body, according to Liddell and Scott. And in that same sense, Paul of Tarsus had used the word, the same word, in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3. The root of the word is auge. It's a compound word, apogasma. The root word is auge, which is the light of the sun. It is certainly not a word belonging to some Hellenistic religious vocabulary, because outside of the wisdom of Solomon, it is not found in any literature until the apostolic age. It appears only in Wisdom of Solomon chapter 7 and in Hebrews chapter 1, and after that, a few times, only in Philo and certain other late religious writings. So the editors of Netz can imagine that the Hellenistic era translator of the Song of Songs could coin several unique words, and they are not labeled as Hellenistic religious words. But why is there a different standard for wisdom, where this and at least one other word they mention appear in wisdom for the very first time in literature? There are actually many words in the New Testament that are also unattested in any earlier writings. That's because we just don't have a complete collection of early Greek writings. We only have fragments and books in diverse places and pieces of books that were preserved. We don't have the entire body of ancient Greek writing, so we certainly don't understand the entire lexicon. We have fairly voluminous lexicons from what we have, but we know they're not complete, because I'm sure you would see apogasma was used all the way back in the classical poets. But those writings that contain it are now lost. Most of Sophocles is lost. Much of Euripides is lost. Aeschylus is lost. And in the pages of Strabo and Diodorus Siculus, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of ancient writers whose works are lost. In fact, good portions of Strabo and Diodorus Siculus are also lost. If a word appears for the first time in a Song of Songs, and the editors of Netz say, oh, the translator of Song of Songs coined the word, then if a word appears for the first time in the Wisdom of Solomon, why don't they say the same thing? Because they have some sort of bias, underlying bias, for possibly some hidden agenda, and they're biased against the Wisdom of Solomon. It's very clear to me, reading this and comparing it to their other critiques and introductions elsewhere. The next word, paraedrus, was a common Greek word appearing in the writings of Euripides, Pindar, Herodotus, excuse me, and many other writers from the classical period, long before the Hellenistic period. So neither is this word peculiar to any so-called Hellenistic religious vocabulary. That's ridiculous. The only Hellenistic religious vocabulary they're found in is the Septuagint and the Song of Solomon. If they had examples from pagan writings, they could supply them, but they supplied none, not any. The word anonuma, or in the masculine gender, anonymous, because it's the masculine gender that you most frequently find in the dictionaries, as the main entry in the dictionaries. Anonymous may mean without name, or, if you haven't guessed, anonymous. It's the word we get anonymous from. Or in another sense in Greek, not to be named, or unspeakable, unnameable. Or even in a third sense, difficult to name. It appears in Greek literature in Homer's Odyssey, in Herodotus, in the poet Euripides and many other writers. So neither is this word peculiar to any so-called Hellenistic religious vocabulary. The Hellenistic period is generally esteemed to begin with Alexander the Great, 330 BC. But the classical period is the period of Euripides and Herodotus and Homer and all of these other writers. Finally, there is Stefano Forusa. That's a tongue twister. That's a participle. Properly, the verb is stenophorio, and the participle is formed from that verb. Stenophorio is simply to wear a wreath. The verb is from the adjective stephaneforos, which means wearing a crown. This is a symbolic use that Paul of Tarsus also employed in his epistles. The overcoming Christians would be crowned with a crown, a Stephanus. Stephanus means crown. Both these words, the verb and the adjective, were used throughout the classical period, from the times of Pindar and Euripides, to describe either victors of the games or rulers in diverse places. Once again, this word is not a part of any merely Hellenistic religious vocabulary. That's ridiculous. Proceeding with the introduction to Nets, the editors next claim that wisdom also uses a Hellenistic philosophical vocabulary of words which are not used in a metaphorical sense in the Septuagint. And this is an outright lie. As examples, they offer four words which they place in this category, once again providing their own one-word definitions. Akolutos, which is unhindered, and that is right. Euergetikos, which is beneficent, and that is right. Nymphe, which is bride, and that is right. And erastes, which is enamored, and that is not really correct because the word is a noun. But examining where these four words appear in the Wisdom of Solomon and where they appear in other Greek writings, neither can it be claimed that any of these words are part of any presumed Hellenistic philosophical vocabulary. Like the supposed Hellenistic religious vocabulary, if these words are found to predate the Hellenistic period, and if these words were used generally in the same contexts and with the same meanings, of course, that they appear in the Wisdom of Solomon, then the editors of Nets have a problem because their claim is patently false. According to Liddell and Scott, the Greek adjective akolutos was used as an adverb, akolutos, 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 the short O and the long O, the omega in the last syllable, by Plato, a writer of the classical period. And therefore, it is not an exclusively Hellenistic term, and it's not a term which was exclusive to religious writing. The verb, the adverb, akolutos, was later used by Luke in Acts chapter 28 and also in Strabo's geography. It is a negated form of the verb kaluo, which is to hinder or prevent, and which appears in Greek writing from the time of Herodotus. Simply because it first appears in Aristotle in the surviving literature does not mean that it is a product of some specialized philosophical vocabulary. Simply because a word first appears in any writer does not mean that the word did not exist earlier, as the simple fact is that comparatively very little earlier Greek writing has even survived to us. For example, both Strabo and Diodorus Siculus list many writers whom they used as sources, but whose works are now lost. The word euergetikos That's also a compound word. Akalutos is a compound word. A lot of these words are compound words. The word euergetikos, ergetikos has to do with working, and eu is a prefix meaning good, positive. So good working. If something's good working, it's beneficent, right? The word euergetikos, beneficent, appears along with akalutos in Wisdom 7:23. This word was also used by Aristotle, but it is later found in the historical writings of Polybius and Diodorus Siculus, so it's not exclusively a religious term. It is merely an adjective form of the noun euergesia, which means well-doing, a good deed or kindness, a good work, literally, which is extant in Greek writings as early as Homer's Odyssey and Hesiod's Theogony. So it is also evident that this word is a classical Greek word and not a Hellenistic philosophical word. Wow. The word nymphe is a common Greek term referring to a bride or married woman, and is also very ancient. The nymphs, this word gave us the mythological nymphs, and nymphe also has the sense of virgin. In Wisdom chapter 8 verse 2, Solomon professes that he sought to make wisdom his spouse or wife, his nymphe. In the same passage, we see the term erastes, which we will discuss next. The word nymphe is used in a metaphorical sense in the Septuagint version of Joel chapter 1, verse 8, where Yahweh, speaking in a metaphorical sense to the nation of Israel, which was often elsewhere considered to be his bride, says, "Lament to me more than a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth." There, Brenton translated nymphe as virgin, but a man's wife, in ancient times, in biblical literature, was esteemed to be his virgin, so long as she remained uncorrupted. The word is used metaphorically once again in Joel chapter 2, verse 18, as the bride mentioned there are the collective children of Israel being asked to gather before their God. In that same manner, it is used in Isaiah 49, verse 18, and Isaiah chapter 61, verse 10. So the editors of Nets have clearly mischaracterized the use of this word in Wisdom, as it is not unique to the Septuagint, or not unique in the Septuagint, within the Septuagint, I should say. The Greek word erastes is a noun related to the verb erastuo. Erastuo is an early lengthening, poetic lengthening. The poets actually lengthened some words so that they could better fit into their meter when they needed a word, when they needed a word in a poem to fit a certain number of syllables and rhythm. So erastuo appears to be a lengthening of ereo or erao, the word for erotic love, the verb that describes erotic love. Erastuo more properly or erastes, I'm sorry, the noun, more properly describes one who loves, admires, or is fond of something. So it is a lover and not, as Netz defines it, enamored. That would be a verb, or perhaps an adjective. According to the 9th edition of Liddell and Scott's Greek-English Lexicon, erastes appears in Greek literature from the time of Herodotus, the classical period, and the verb form was used by Aeschylus. So the word is also a classical Greek word and not merely a Hellenistic philosophical word. In Wisdom, it is used much the same way that it appears in Hosea, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, metaphorically, of the lovers of ancient Israel, which were the idols they worshipped and the alien nations with whom they had made covenants. Solomon used it to describe himself as a lover of wisdom, So the editors of Nets also wrongly stated that the metaphorical use of this word was peculiar to wisdom. They just lie. Or they copied a liar without checking his work, is what they really did, I believe. Now, in the penultimate argument which we have from Nets, as it is also near the end of their supposed proofs for a Hellenistic origin of wisdom, the editors claim that examples of Hellenistic ethical vocabulary are to be found in the terms used for virtues and vices in wisdom, such as anexicacia, long-suffering or forbearance, or epiorchia, which is perjury. They say it's one of a list of vices in Wisdom chapter 14. And examples of psychological vocabulary. Yeah, we're really going to have fun with this one. Examples of psychological vocabulary are to be found in the terms used to describe the fear that gripped the lawless Egyptians in Wisdom 17, such as indalma, or apparitions, or dimata, terrors, or in such terms as apotomus, which is stern or severe. Now, the first word in this category is found only in the Wisdom of Solomon, and after that in Plutarch, at least several hundred years later, about 150 AD maybe, and then in much later grammatical or historical writing, according to Liddell and Scott. So anexicacia is a rare word, which evidently appears only in the Wisdom of Solomon in pre-Christian writing. Plutarch was not a Christian, but he came after Christ had, and after the apostolic age. However, I would think that to qualify as an example of Hellenistic ethical vocabulary, the word would have to appear in Hellenistic ethical writings, which it does not. Neither does Nets give credit to wisdom, to the author of wisdom, with having coined this word, as they had done with the words which first appear in Greek in the Song of Songs. So they're hypocrites once again. The next word in their examples, epiorchia, is a false oath, and it appears in the historical writing of Xenophon, as well as in the philosophical writing of his contemporary Plato. The corresponding adjective, epiorchus, was common and appeared as early as Homer's Iliad and various works by Hesiod. So this is not merely a word from Hellenistic ethical vocabulary, having appeared frequently long before the Hellenistic period began. The word indalma, in the plural, indalmata, or apparitions, appears in the Septuagint in Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 39. And Jeremiah certainly cannot be accused of having been a Hellenistic psychologist, while the noun form of the word is not found in any surviving ancient Greek writings. That does not mean that it did not exist. The verb form, indalomahi, to appear, seem, or resemble, appears in both the Iliad and Odyssey of Homer and in many later writings. So the editors of Nets are not only wrong, but apparently too indolent to even check the veracity of their own sources. And I use that term, indolent, in this paragraph on the word indalma quite purposely. The word daima, which in the plural is daimata, that's how it appears in Scripture, is fear or an object of fear, terror. In both senses, it appears in Homer's Iliad and in the poems of Sophocles. It also appears, in one sense or the other, in Aeschylus, Herodotus, and many other early writers, asserting that this word is merely a part of some Hellenistic ethical or psychological vocabulary, is also a failure, to say the least. These first four words appear only once each in the Wisdom of Solomon. They don't appear in other writing in the Septuagint. So I don't know how they are Hellenistic or peculiarly Hellenistic terms at all, because they appear in the Wisdom of Solomon, but they appear in a whole collection of early classical writings. They can't be Hellenistic religious words or a Hellenistic religious vocabulary if, in Hellenistic religious material, they only appear in the Wisdom of Solomon. They're classical Greek words. They're ancient words that the author of the Wisdom of Solomon or his translator had employed. Their last example appears several times, which is the word apotamos. It comes from the preposition apo and an adjective form, I believe, of the verb temno, which means to cut off. It is a compound word defined in Liddell and Scott as cut off, abrupt, or precipitous, where it appears in Herodotus, but metaphorically, from one who comes suddenly to the edge of a cliff, where it is found in Sophocles. In a secondary sense, it is metaphorically severe or relentless, and it's used in the Wisdom of Solomon apparently to mean severe. In a secondary sense, it is metaphorically severe or relentless where it appears in Euripides. That's the classical period. That's the 5th century BC. And that is the same sense in which it is employed in Wisdom. But like Jeremiah, Euripides was not a Hellenistic psychologist. There is a feminine form, apotamos, which is abrupt or sheer, etc. And that also appears in the classical writings. Even if most of these words appear nowhere else in the Septuagint, and not even in the New Testament, that does not mean that they are peculiar to Hellenistic writings of any sort, religious, philosophical, ethical, or psychological, since nearly all of them are from the much more ancient classical period and were used commonly in prose histories, as well as in the poets, in the same senses in which they appear in the Wisdom of Solomon. So they're not specialized words of any Hellenistic sort of writing, category of writing. Those few examples here that are not found prior to the Wisdom of Solomon do not meet that criteria either, because they were not used again until the Apostolic Age or later. So until further evidence is found, then it is evident that they were first used in the Wisdom of Solomon and may have been coined by its author or translator for his own intentions. But they certainly cannot be attributed to any presumed Hellenistic philosophy or psychology or religion or nets, and its sources should have been able to explain precisely how they were introduced by any particular Hellenistic philosopher or psychologist. And they didn't. And they can't. They can. They're just making a claim that levels a charge at the Wisdom of Solomon that cannot be substantiated, and which is obviously not true. Here it should be manifest that most of the criticisms of the Wisdom of Solomon found in Nets or other discussions of this book are based on lies, or at least on highly dubious premises. and we cannot be compelled to accept any of them, not one. But now the Mets editors conclude their criticisms with a charge that we have already addressed in response to other critics, where they state, "Finally, it may be observed that the author quotes from the Septuagint in a number of places," and they cite Wisdom chapter 2 verse 12 and Isaiah chapter 3 verse 10, Wisdom 11:22 and Isaiah 40:15, and Wisdom 16:22 and Exodus 9:24. Now, in the opening presentation of this commentary on Wisdom, we have already discredited the claim that the author of Wisdom simply quoted or copied from Isaiah 2:12, Isaiah 3:10, and Isaiah chapter 40, verse 20, as well as from certain passages found in Job chapter 9. Now, the Nets editors add to this list the claim that Wisdom 11:22 copies from Isaiah 40:15, and Wisdom 16:22 copies from Exodus 9:24. So now, we shall address these claims by making the same type of comparison which we have made for those verses that we have already addressed. First, to compare Wisdom 11:22 with Job chapter 40, verse 15. "For the whole world before thee is as a little grain of the balance." Yeah, as a drop of the morning dew that falleth down upon the earth. Now, one word is translated by Brenton, "a little grain," and that word is hrope. I won't repeat the entire Greek verse. I will spare you. The phrase is hrope ek plastikon, plastikon. It's almost like our word plastic with N-G-O-N at the end, plastingon, perhaps. And it means scale. So, once again, Brenton had followed the King James Version rather than the original Greek here in Wisdom, but did better where he translated the same word in Isaiah. The phrase, little grain, in this passage should have been turning, as he had translated it in Isaiah. The word rope, in this context, is an inclination downwards, the sinking of the scale, because it is used along with the word, which literally means scale. Now, Isaiah chapter 40, verse 15. "Since all the nations are counted as a drop from a bucket, and as the turning of a balance, and shall be counted as spittle." Now, I will again spare you reading the entire Greek passage, but the turning of a balance comes from two words, rope zugo, or zugu. Zugu is the genitive form of the word zugus, which is a yoke, or a crossbar forming a yoke to which oxen are harnessed. So even though these two passages express a similar concept, there is really only one significant word in common in the two passages, which is rope. So how does that qualify as a quotation? How? One word? The word appears probably a dozen times in the Septuagint. The same word, rope. Moreover, the noun accompanying rope in Wisdom is plastinx, which is an actual balance, while the noun accompanying rope in Isaiah is zugus, which is a crossbeam or crossbar, and was often, being related to oxen, translated as yoke, even in the New Testament. Perhaps in Isaiah, the phrase hos rope zugo would be better translated, turning of a yoke, since that is more literal and does not change the implied meaning. This is not a quotation, but it is an example of two different ways to describe the same concept, which is the state of all nations, or the whole world, in the face of the judgment of God. The same phrase in Isaiah, rope zugu, appears in Proverbs chapter 16, the same phrase seen here in Isaiah. Appears in Proverbs chapter 16, where Solomon had written, and as Brenton had translated it, the poise of the balance, poise being rope there. The poise of the balance is righteous with the Lord, and his works are righteous measures. So did the author of Proverbs quote from Isaiah, or Isaiah from Proverbs, because that's two consecutive words that are exactly alike. That's ridiculous, right? The phrase found in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 15, Pantata ephthe, or all the nations, is found quite often in Psalms in the same context, referring to the impending judgment of God upon all nations. But the phrase holos hokosmos, or the whole world, found in Wisdom 11:22, is found only in the Wisdom of Solomon or in the Proverbs, which was written by Solomon out of all the books of the Septuagint. This passage of wisdom is certainly not a quote from Isaiah, and the charge is fairly ridiculous, but it shows that the vocabulary is closer to Solomon than all of the other similar expressions found in the Septuagint. Now to compare Wisdom chapter 16, verse 22, with Exodus chapter 9, verse 24, reading from Wisdom 16, 22. But snow and ice endured the fire, and we will discuss the context of this very soon. But snow and ice endured the fire and melted not, that they might know that fire burning in the hail and sparkling in the rain did destroy the fruits of the enemies. Now, there are two words there, two terms, I'm sorry, one small word and one phrase, which match a word and a phrase exactly in Exodus chapter 9, verse 24. That is the word for fire, the first word for fire, not the second, and the phrase in the hail. That's it, in the hail, fire and in the hail. So, in Exodus 9:24, we see, so there was hail and flaming fire. We only had fire in Wisdom. Flaming fire mingled with hail. And the hail was very great, such as was not in Egypt from the time there was a nation upon it. Now, we see that word per is fire, and the phrase ente kaladze is literally in the hail. And that's how it was translated in Wisdom 16:22. But it's mingled with hail in the Septuagint in Exodus chapter 9, verse 24, in Brenton's Septuagint. So, mingled with hail in this context is fine as a translation. That's fine. But it's really just in the hail, literally. These are the only two significant words or phrases found in common in these passages. The word per is the common Greek word for fire. And the phrase ente kaladze is literally in the hail, but may be rendered with the hail. For that reason, Brenton rendered it in the context of Exodus chapter 9:24 as mingled with hail. The balance of the two passages are significantly different one from another. The end of the similarities is right there in four words, one word and one three-word phrase, and that's it. And this is basically the, well, there's other words in Greek that can be translated as fire, but literally mean flame. Flame is also seen in this passage as phlogizon, flaming fire. In that case, it's a participle. Or phlegomenon in Wisdom of Solomon. But they are two different forms of the same word, and you can't say that one is a copy of the other. You might be able to claim that they are close, or close enough to be a quote. I seriously doubt it. So I didn't even mark them as the same. If we did want to mark them as being the same, then we have a five-word phrase. But that doesn't even disturb me, the five-word phrase, which was flaming fire mingled with hail in Exodus and fire burning in the hail in Wisdom. And that's also fine. So at the most, we have a five-word phrase. But is the quote, because the grammar is slightly different first. In this passage of Wisdom, it was the author's intent to recount what things Yahweh had done to the Egyptians at the time of the Exodus. That was the purpose for Wisdom chapter 16, verse 22. It's part of a description of what happened in Exodus chapter 9, and the part described at verse 24. It was the author's intent to recount these things that Yahweh had done to the Egyptians at the time of the Exodus, which are described in that chapter of Exodus. And the only language in common with the Greek of Exodus are these very common words for fire, burning, and hail. While huetos, or rain, it appears in this passage in Wisdom, and it is found several times in Exodus chapter 9. It is not found in this verse, which the author of Wisdom is supposedly quoting, Exodus 9:24. Likewise, the verb ginosko, to know, is found in Exodus 9:29, but not here in verse 24. There are 9 other significant words in Wisdom 16:22, which are not at all found in Exodus chapter 9. This is not a quotation, not at all. And because of the many disparate words between the two versions, it does not even qualify as a paraphrase of a longer pericope from that chapter of Exodus. Rather, it is only a repetition of plain terms in one account, which was intentionally based upon the older account, but which actually only resembles it in a very small degree. A phrase of 5 letters with one word being of a different form, even though it's the same word. Or one word and then a phrase of 3 letters, however you want to look at it, is immaterial. The second writer, here the author of Wisdom, would naturally have license in such an instance, since he's describing something from Exodus chapter 9, to quote from the original account at length. But the fact that there is only one common word, or I should say one very short phrase, is actually proof that he did not quote directly from this or any other verse of Exodus. Then, once we understand that, it's clear that our author of the Wisdom of Solomon, was not writing this looking at Exodus, copying from Exodus as it was already translated into Septuagint. That's not true. Fire burning in the hail. If you have ever seen the Hebrew of Exodus chapter 9 repetitively, and you wanted to go and describe the events of Exodus chapter 9, it's no big thing that you came very close to the grammar of the Septuagint Exodus when you wrote fire burning in the hail. Come on, how many ways are there to say that in Greek? One, just one. If I had to describe what happened in Genesis chapter 3 in English, having only a copy of a Hebrew or Greek manuscript in hand, and if in the resulting text I used the words ate from the tree, or he ate from the tree, so that we get five words there. But no other words were in common to the Genesis text of the King James Version. The editors of Netz would evidently assume that I had nevertheless quoted from the King James Version, or copied from the King James Version, and that is ridiculous. But that is essentially what they are doing here regarding the Wisdom of Solomon. So of all of the criticisms of the Wisdom of Solomon, which I have seen thus far, I have been compelled to accept none. Most of them are actually lies or ludicrous stretches of the imagination. This is the product of biblical scholarship in mainstream academia today, and in my opinion, it is absolutely worthless. Now to return to the actual text of the Wisdom of Solomon, which we have already stated is the best way to determine the true providence of the work, whether or not it was indeed inspired by Yahweh, our God. As we also already said, the earliest Christian writers, those of the first and second centuries of the Christian era, certainly did accept this book into their canon. We cannot imagine that they were deceived by a Hellenistic psychologist, as we have also presented here from other sources. The Wisdom of Solomon in Greek is a work of poetry, and it is presented in that manner in the pages of Ralph's edition of the Septuagint. Other Old Testament works were also written poetically, especially the Psalms, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, and early portions of scripture such as the Song of Moses or the Song of Deborah, as well as the entire book of Job. In Ralph's Septuagint, Job, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the apocryphal book of Odes and Wisdom of Sirach are also arranged poetically, even though they only appear in prose in our King James and most other English translations. We have already explained that the first verse of Wisdom, where it says, "Love righteousness, ye that be judges of the earth. Think of the Lord with a good heart, and in simplicity of heart seek him," is making a general address to the children of Israel. Those of them who are faithful to God and do love righteousness, as it is they who certainly are destined to be the judges of the earth. For that same purpose, Paul of Tarsus had told the Corinthians in chapter 10 of his second epistle to them that they should remain in a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. To this day, Christians as a whole have still not fulfilled that obedience. Now, in that same regard, Solomon continues here in Wisdom, exhorting the judges of the earth and introducing them to Wisdom herself. "For he will be found of them," referring to God, "for he will be found of them that tempt him not, and showeth himself unto such as do not distrust him." The verb for tempt is pirazo, and does not mean that man can successfully coax God into sin, or even anger, as the word tempt is often used today. Tempt does not mean that you actually consummated the act, and it's often misconstrued in that manner. The lesson of the prophets, as well as the revelation, is that God acts on his own volition at a time which he has appointed. As we read in the aforementioned sorites of Hosea chapter 2, "And it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith Yahweh. I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth, and the earth shall hear the corn, and the wine, and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel." God sows, so the end of the sorites. "And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, Thou art my people, and they shall say, Thou art my God." The time in which that day comes to pass is already appointed by God, according to the prophecies in many other scriptures. The day of wrath. And its resulting aftermath. Rather, the verb for tent is pirazo, and it is primarily to make proof or trial of. Or here, where it is used with the accusative case in regard to a person, to try, tempt a person, put him to the test, according to Liddell and Scott. And it implies action only on the part of the man who initiates the action in the active sense, where it cannot be inferred that the person or God who is the object of the verb here is actually moved by the action. Yahweh God cannot be compelled by the actions of men to render either judgment or mercy. But by sinning, man is tempting God, as man accepts the chance that God may not act in judgment, or that he somehow shall not suffer the consequences of his sin. It is inevitable that men themselves are tempted by things which they see in the world. But it is in this sense that man does not tempt God, that Christ had told his disciples to pray, "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." That they are not led into sin, being drawn away by the things which are seen in the world. Having faith in God, man keeps himself from sin. And as Christ had said in John chapter 14, "He that has my commandments and keeps them, he it is that loves me. And he that loves me shall be loved of my Father, and I will love him and will manifest myself to him. He will be found of them that tempt him not, because they keep his commandments, and shows himself unto such as do not distrust him, who trust him to the point where they know that they should keep his commandments." And then in verse 3 of Wisdom, "For froward thoughts separate from God, and his power, when it is tried, reproves the unwise." Where it says froward, the Greek word is scolios, which is curved or winding. There's a condition in the spine which is named for it. And then metaphorically, it is crooked, which is to mean perverse, unjust, or unrighteous. This word is common in Proverbs, but was only used a few times elsewhere, and by Luke, Paul, and Peter in the New Testament. The word for thoughts is logismus, which is more precisely reasoning or reckoning. It appears over 100 times in the Septuagint, often in the Psalms and the Prophets and in Solomon's other writings, and twice in the epistles of Paul. The word for tried here is dokimazo, which is a synonym of pirazo, or tempt. And according to Liddell and Scott, Dokimazo means to assay or test metals to see if they be pure. But in a secondary sense, and from the earliest Greek historians of persons, to put to the test, to make trial of, or scrutinize. The word for reprove here is elenxo. That's how it should be pronounced. Elenxo, which can mean to disgrace or put to shame, but was also used more formally in matters of law and government to cross-examine, question, for the purpose of disproving or reproving, and therefore to be convicted, to disprove, confute, then used generally simply to prove. In the New Testament, Paul of Tarsus used the term frequently in that sense. The word appears frequently in Paul and a few times in other New Testament writings. It also appears often throughout the Septuagint, but especially in the wisdom literature. Perverse thoughts do indeed separate a man from God, but by themselves they are not necessarily sin, or at least they are not punished until they are acted upon. In turn, their punishment convicts them, the people who commit them, their punishment convicts them of their sin. It is that to which Solomon refers here when he says, when it is tried. And he is warning that sin shall indeed be punished by God, that a man will not escape the consequences, one way or another. Thus we read in James chapter 1, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. But for that, he is not yet going to be punished because there's no action involved. Then in the next verse, then when lust has conceived, when you actually act on your lustful feelings, the lustful feelings are wrong and we should overcome them. Then when lust has conceived, it brings forth sin. So the sin isn't sin until an action occurs as a result of the lust. And sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. Moving on to verse 4. For into a malicious soul wisdom shall not enter, nor dwell in the body that is subject unto sin. In Proverbs chapter 1, and I will probably make a lot of comparisons to Proverbs and perhaps to Ecclesiastes as we proceed through this Wisdom of Solomon, and also, I believe, to the letters of Paul. In Proverbs chapter 1, we see an elaborate depiction of this same concept in Solomon's personification of wisdom. Some people may call it an anthropomorphism, but in this sense, I'd rather call it a personification. Wisdom crieth without. She utters her voice in the streets. She cries in the chief place of concourse, in the openings of the gates. In the city she utters her word, saying, how long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? And the scorners delight in her scorning, and the fools hate knowledge. Turn you at my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you. I will make known my words unto you. Because I have called, and you refused, I have stretched out my hand, and no man regarded. But you have said it not all my counsel, and would none of my reproof. In other words, and would have none of my reproof. That word, simplicity, in the opening of this passage which we are citing, may have been translated as foolishness or naivety. And for that reason, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear comes. When your fear comes as desolation, and your destruction comes as a whirlwind, and we have seen, and I have exhibited recently, that fear itself is a punishment from God. And that's in Deuteronomy chapter 28. When your fear comes, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. It's too late. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me, for that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of Yahweh. They would none of my counsel. In other words, they would have none of my counsel, or they wanted none of my counsel. They despised all my reproof. We see the same message here, expressed in very different terms in this opening chapter of Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 1. It must be noted that in the Proverbs, Solomon is careful to define the wisdom of which he speaks before he creates his personification, where he wrote in verse 7 of Proverbs chapter 1, "The fear of Yahweh is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." Here in the Wisdom of Solomon and in Ecclesiastes as well, we cannot imagine that Solomon is referring to any wisdom but that wisdom which comes from God. As he defines wisdom in that same way later on within the context of this chapter, the wisdom of man is merely knowledge that man collects and processes for himself, which is accumulated from a limited perspective and which is not always accurate, no matter how eloquently it may be expressed, or with what degree of erudition it may seem to reflect. It is folly, apart from or in opposition to God. It is deceitful for man to think that he may possess wisdom apart from God. So Solomon continues in verse 5. "For the Holy Spirit of discipline will flee deceit and remove from thoughts that are without understanding." Remove, that word really means to stand apart from or stand afar from. "And will not abide when unrighteousness comes in." And where the texts have, and when I say the texts here, I say it to describe both the King James Apocrypha translation and Brenton Septuagint translation. Because throughout this entire first chapter of Wisdom, and if I remember properly, throughout most, if not all, of the book of the Wisdom of Solomon, Brenton basically simply fabricated or copied the King James translation. He did not make an original translation here. For at least most, if not all, of this book, it's pretty sad, actually. He probably didn't get a chance to finish it. I don't know. And perhaps somebody just used the King James Apocrypha to finish it. I don't know. I don't know the story of the making of Brenton Septuagint. But in the main body of the Old Testament, Brenton did, as far as I ever saw, create his own original translation of the Greek. In the apocryphal books, it's mostly just copies of what the King James has, so far as I've seen. So I'll be commenting on that throughout the series as well, but probably only if I find a verse that's different from the King James. Where the text have "will not abide when," the Holy Spirit will not abide when unrighteousness cometh in. Where they have "will not abide when," there is only a single verb, which is once again a form of that word alegko or alengso. The verb depending on what tense it is in. It could be a lanko or a langso, a ch before the last vowel, or an x before the last vowel. And that's the verb which was translated as reprove in verse 3. We would have the last clause of this verse to read quite literally, and convicts or reproves for the coming unrighteousness. That phrase, will not abide when, is just not a translation of the verb. And convicts the coming unrighteousness, where we have added only the article. There is a notable example of this, which occurred not long before Solomon was born, and within the experience of David his father, where we read in 1 Samuel chapter 16 that for his own disobedience, the Holy Spirit departed from King Saul. And the text says in verse 14, the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. So where Solomon wrote that the Holy Spirit of discipline will flee deceit and remove or stand far away from thoughts that are without understanding and convicts the coming unrighteousness. When you deceive yourself, when you become disobedient to God, when you turn to sin, there's no doubt that unrighteousness is coming and the Holy Spirit will convict you of it. The Spirit of God will convict you of it, and you will be punished for your sin. Of course, Saul's own spirit would still have been within him. But being vexed by an evil spirit, evil in the eyes of men, but not necessarily evil in the eyes of God, Saul was ultimately punished for his disobedience. Now, as Christ had repeatedly told his disciples, if you love me, keep my commandments, we read in verse 6. For wisdom is a loving spirit, and will not acquit a blasphemer of his words, or literally of his lips. For God is witness of his reins, and a true beholder of his heart, and a hearer of his tongue. The word for reins is nephros, which in the plural, as it is here, literally refers to the kidneys. In the epistles of Paul, and once each in Acts and in 1 John, a more general word is used in the same sense, which is splanchnon, and refers more generally to the inner parts of a man. In this sense, nephros is found in the Septuagint in 1 Maccabees, in the wisdom literature, by which I also mean to include the Psalms, and in Jeremiah. So we see in Brenton's Septuagint in Jeremiah chapter 11, O Lord that judges righteously, trying the reins and the hearts. In biblical literature, the King James Version, the Septuagint, nephron or nephros in the plural, nephron, was often translated as reins. In the seventh psalm, we read, for the righteous God trieth the reins and the hearts, or the hearts and the reins, I'm sorry. In our opening presentation in this series, we describe the index of citations and allegations of Old Testament scriptures, which are esteemed to be found in the New Testament. Here is our first entry for the wisdom of Solomon, and it references Titus chapter 3, verse 4, and 1 Peter chapter 2, 25. In that passage of Titus, Paul writes of the kindness and love of God, but the context is quite different, and I would not make the connection. In 1 Peter 2, 25, it is not any more relevant except that the love of God is reflected in his mercy. Here, the warning of Solomon is more relevant to scriptures portraying judgment rather than mercy, as mercy only comes with repentance. So where wisdom will not acquit a blasphemer of his words, We see in 1 Timothy chapter 1, where Paul of Tarsus recounts the treachery which he suffered at the hand of some false disciples, whom had made shipwreck of the faith, as he had described it. And he said, "Of whom is Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have delivered unto Satan, that they learn not to blaspheme." As Yahweh used his enemies to punish his children in the Old Testament, so it was in the days of Paul, and so it is now, and it will continue to be. It will continue to be until we do turn to obedience so that we could fulfill our role as judges of the earth. Yahweh willing, we shall return to our commentary on the wisdom of Solomon in the very near future. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.